Hello again, people of Earth. You are listening to F This Movie, the podcast that will affect us all in the future.
And you should be interested in the future, because that is where you're going to be spending the rest of your lives. And remember, future podcasts such as this will affect us in the future.
I'm joined today by the second worst director of all time, Mr. JB.
I would prefer for this podcast you refer to me as Eros, a soldier of my planet.
Once again, you are listening to F This Movie. You can visit our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com, and you can find us in the iTunes store, where we now have all of our old shows, thanks to Eric Asperschlager, savior of F This Movie. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, and you can listen to us on dvdverdictpresents.com. And I have to get all that stuff out of the way before I forget. Am I missing anything? Oh, Facebook. Facebook.com/FThisMovie. And follow us on Twitter. Twitter.com/FThisMovie. For hilarious 140 character pieces of news and jokes.
Doug has been so successful in getting us a presence on new media. I don't want to spill the beans. Maybe he wants to reveal this himself, but in the very near future, we will also be on Google Maps, which means that you can follow the movements of the F This Movie podcasters, and if we say something that pisses you off, you can see where we are, you can hunt us down, and shoot us in the head.
Did you know Michael Madsen is following us on Twitter?
I heard that. Yeah. I heard a rumor to that effect.
Yes. So all of the big stars are now hooked on F This Movie.
And I would
and
just
by
like...
all of the big stars, I mean all of the big stars of 1992.
And I would just like to say to Michael Madsen, you can say whatever you want, but I'm going to torture you anyway.
Today, of course, is a very special F This Movie because this is our 50th show.
Yay! Woo!
There's confetti dropping from the ceiling.
Look, it's a big duck.
And a big duck. The F This Movie duck.
The magic word. What is the magic word?
I don't know.
The secret word.
The secret word?
Say the secret word and the dog will come down and give you $10.
So this is our 50th show. Yay. It seems like just yesterday we had done zero shows.
And speaking of the 50th, according to Patrick, iTunes, which as I understand it is a series of tubes.
iTunes.
Will only hold 50 of them. So the minute the 51st podcast is posted, Avatar will go back to its previous designation of literally going for thousands of dollars on eBay. So listen to Avatar while you still can.
And for our 50th show, of course, it makes sense to talk about the worst movie of all time.
Which, of course, is not the worst movie
exactly.
of all time.
Exactly. It used to be described as the worst movie of all time. There are other movies that now give it a run for its money. Plan 9 from Outer Space, directed by Edward D. Wood, Jr. Now Troll 2 and The Room get a lot of attention as being possibly the worst movies of all time. Because irony.
Well, I have a theory about the worst movie of all time. Because this book was released called The 50 Worst Films of All Time by... these two authors, and one of the author wound up being a fake author, made-up name, because it was Michael Medved.
Oh, right.
And Medved felt that it was going to adversely affect his career, and then, interestingly enough, once the book took off, he started...
It was me all along!
Right, and then they published a book called The Golden Turkey Awards, This was really the beginning of sort of mining this... underbelly media from the past for its ironic value. But for the longest time, I thought that there was an actual sort of capitalist push behind it where can we find something that is ignored or forgotten, and more importantly, in the public domain,
right,
and create a demand for it? Because Plan 9 was in the public domain, and certainly it being written up in those books and it's suddenly getting a lot of mileage and midnight screenings and stuff, put money in someone's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't Ed, because Ed was dead.
Right.
I suspect it was Wade Williams, who now holds the copyright on some version. But I did want to mention, when I went to iTunes, which I love, to perhaps purchase the film, it's very inexpensive, befitting its public domain status.
Right.
And then I started to cast about thinking, are there other podcasts on Plan 9? And there's a couple of them.
I would think, yeah.
Let's just leave it at that. But there's a video podcast called The Church of UHF or something.
Okay.
If you search for podcasts on Plan 9, you will discover this. And what it is, it's a short video introduction, and then the entire film.
Oh.
For free. Okay. So it's in the public domain. There's, I mean, obviously, if you want to pay $4 for it, that's your business. But it is available as this podcast. And in fact, one of the first comments on the podcast was, do not pay $4 to buy this film. You know, it's like Homer at the museum. You don't really have to pay. If you get this podcast, and as befitting a movie that quickly slips into delirium, the introduction is this young man dressed as the Pope, a fairly elaborate Pope costume, in front of a green screen background, and it has UHF written on the Pope hat, and it's some sort of tongue-in-cheek cult of bad movies, and he introduces the film, and then the entire film is available as a video podcast. So seek that out. It's in the public domain. But originally, and I think this was the early 80s, when the 50 worst films of all time came out. And certainly to people who had never seen Plan 9, a written description of it does sound horrible.
Yeah, or not.
And there are horrible parts. As I watched it again, I was reminded of something that I teach my students every year, that when you start editing film, there's this phenomenon called the Kuleshov effect, where the audience will assume a connection between any two shots in sequence. And I don't think any director in the history of the medium has taken advantage of that to the extent that Ed Wood has. The only way this narrative makes sense is that the juxtaposition of shots carries right. you along.
Right.
Because many writers have commented, it's day, it's night, it's day, it's night. But if someone in the night is walking from screen left to screen right, and then someone in the light is running from screen left to screen right, you're going to assume that there's a chase going on.
Right.
Even though the chase is being created in the editing room. And my favorite example of it is, because as they pointed out in the movie Ed Wood with Johnny Depp, the Tim Burton biopic, that Ed was in love with stock footage because it was things he couldn't possibly
right.
film on his right. own. When the United States starts firing on the flying saucers, there's all this army footage of big cannons going off, big guns being shot, boom, 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 boom. And then we cut to the two actors who are playing the army guys in a medium shot against a blank background. And they talk and they point, and it's uncanny that you do kind of assume that they're standing right next to the cannon.
Right.
It's just not in the shot. So, hats off to Ed.
It's not the worst movie ever made, everyone. And you should see it if you haven't yet. But before we really dive into Plan 9, considered perhaps the worst science fiction movie ever made, if not the worst movie ever made, we have to talk about some other science fiction movies that we saw recently.
Yes.
At the Sci-Fi Spectacular at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, which we attended last week, and we saw a bunch of science fiction movies. We saw The Day the World Ended,
which was a last-minute substitution. Apparently the print of Not of This Earth was unshowable.
I had never seen Not of This Earth, but I had also never seen The Day the World Ended, so I wasn't too disappointed.
And The Day the World Ended played really well
yeah.
to what the audience wanted out of a 50s science fiction film. There was enough ironic opportunities
right.
to keep people happy. For anyone who would like to see Not of This Earth, I discovered after the Sci-Fi Spectacular, Amazon is having a sale. You can purchase with money
Whoa.
A DVD of Not of This Earth, Attack of the Crab Monsters,
okay.
which might be the worst movie yeah. ever made. A couple months ago, I saw that at the Portage. Oh, my God. And War of the Satellites. So it's a Roger Corman triple feature. It's on DVD. And it has a bonus feature, 25 Corman trailers.
Cool.
And it's $12.
Wow.
which is quite the bargain.
Yeah, right.
Rusty Nails, who runs the Sci-Fi Spectacular, who we love.
That's right.
Also showed Krull, which I had never seen before.
Yeah.
And seemed a naked attempt out of hundreds of naked attempts to cash in on Star Wars.
Yes, absolutely. I have some affection for the first 5 years in the 80s because there was a lot of science fiction and fantasy being put out, and that doesn't happen anymore really at all. But there was a lot of that going on in the early 80s. A lot of it was terrible, but yes. I grew up on a lot of it because it showed on HBO all the time. Krull was one of those movies. And I remembered liking Krull as a kid because there were three or four things that stuck in my memory. The giant spider, or the glaive that he throws, or there's a few like set pieces that stick out in my mind, and I liked Krull as a kid, but I can't believe watching Krull as an adult that I ever had the attention span to watch Krull as a kid, because it's tedious. Everything takes place in real time.
Yeah, you pointed that out.
If they have to ride from one place to another, we see the whole ride.
By God, we're going to ride. None of that movie time shortening. And I was watching it, and I had never seen it before. And I actually thought, in trying to garner the science fiction audience, that may have been a mistake, because it seemed to me, as slow and stodgy as parts of it were, that it was an honest attempt to do the Joseph Campbell hero journey, and that every time more obvious science fiction tropes raise their ugly head, that it didn't work, that it came across as this movie could almost be timeless, because parts of it look really quite beautiful. The sets are certainly really impressive.
Yeah.
And then suddenly when we get these laser beams coming out of sticks, you're thinking, that's not necessary. And even the glaive, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Would work if it's this magic talisman that lights up and spins. I think we could deal with that in the universe of Krull. But
it's a Excalibur, right?
That in trying to make it more overtly science fiction, they sort of shot themselves in the foot. And it was really great to see Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
What must have been his first movie.
Early, that, very and, close. That and Excalibur, I think, were... Excalibur might have been first, but...
And Robbie Coltrane.
Very early, yeah.
Who, for some reason, shows up... He's the only one in the film without period hair.
Right.
They decided no wig for Robbie. He sort of comes across as this working-class Englishman from the 80s, like he works in some coal plant or something. Well, because he's dirty. But... And because we now know them as movie stars, it's surprising when those characters meet their fates, because it's like, because they weren't stars back then.
Right.
They were cannon fodder.
But it's also interesting to see them, who we know are much more interesting and likable and charismatic as movie stars than the lead actor of Krull, Ken... It's not Ken Russell, but it's something like that.
Ken, instantly forgettable.
Yes. Who is one of the weakest movie leads I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Really, really terrible.
And then Rusty showed Critters 2, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And certainly played for the audience.
Yeah.
In much the same way that we found that...
Killer Clowns.
That Killer Clowns at the massacre was sort of this palate cleanser.
Right.
And that I was really surprised, because occasionally you'll find one of these directors who's just starting out, who actually has the skill and the taste and the intelligence and the sense of humor to sort of imbue this sort of low-budget sequel with something fun. And say what you want about Critters 2, there's a lot of little bits of business in it that are very funny and were obviously worked out. And that's something... that young people and people just starting out can add to the film, because it doesn't cost extra. You just you have to come up with these ideas, sort of little bits of business. And then, in true marathon fashion, we get Naked Lunch, the requisite David Cronenberg film.
The whole day was kind of a roller coaster, because you have this thing
that's a good way to describe it.
Energetic and entertaining, and then you crash down to the earth with Krull, and then you're back up with Critters 2, and then Naked Lunch, and you're back down. because Naked Lunch is not a crowd pleaser.
I don't think it's trying to be a crowd
pleaser. No, 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 not at all. I don't know. It's I think it's interesting, only although I commented, I think, after we saw it, that it really reminded me a lot of
Videodrome.
Yeah, which is a movie I like much better.
Its narrative really seems sort of based on that. And it's an admirable attempt to adapt a book,
an unfilmable book,
completely unfilmable.
The other movie it reminded me of was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Because they're both sort of these adaptations of books that maybe aren't particularly cinematic.
Non-adaptable.
Right.
And then we saw Rubber, which is that available on...
It's on demand currently. It's playing like in limited release, maybe, or not even yet. But you can watch it on demand.
And it's going to get a limited release as the next month sort of rolls out. And I thought Rubber was a really pleasant surprise. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
It was more self-aware than I thought it was
going to be. I would argue it was too self-aware.
Right, that there's too much of an ironic gloss. There is a problem when the sheriff's opening speech, for me, was the highlight of the film. That's pretty hard to sustain when you start with that. Well,
the director must have felt the same thing, because then he plays it again over the end credits.
Yes.
But from a different angle. So let's watch it again, only another guy's reaction to it. I didn't hate Rubber, although I hated things about Rubber. There were things about it that I liked and found admirable, but parts of that movie were making me crazy. Like, I've never seen a movie, to quote something your son once said, I've never seen a movie more up its own ass.
Yes.
And that was really bothering me. And it was really working with the audience, and so, yay, way to go. But there were things in that movie that were really bothering me.
And I think my final comment was that, and again, to reference my son, that it's very, very difficult to make a short film and have it have the right amount of stuff for a short film. That when you see a student film that's maybe 15, 20 minutes, it's usually a 5-minute film artificially blown up in the padding shows, or worst of all, it is an hour and a half film that's been accordioned down and shoehorned into this little tiny 20-minute box. And I really thought Rubber was a short film that had been expanded artificially to feature length. And then Rusty showed The Blob, the Chuck Russell remake of The Blob, which Patrick loves.
I do.
And I like.
Okay.
But again, the original is not a very good film.
Right.
There are long stretches of the original that are boring and amateurish.
Right.
But I have such, you know, this is that HBO phenomenon for your generation.
Definitely.
I have such an amount of affection for the original Blob.
Yeah.
That I think that gets in my way. All the other thing that gets in my way is Kevin Dillon,
okay,
who is supposed to be the bad boy,
yeah,
but is presented as being so clean and right, so coiffed.
Right, he has a mullet.
I can't get around his hair.
Sort of, the mullet is and that dates the movie perhaps more than and that and like Shawnee Smith's clothing.
He's got a black leather jacket and a white button-down shirt
tucked in.
Yeah,
yeah, that always distracts me.
Without the jacket, he kind of looks like a bullfighter.
I really like that movie. I really think that's a good remake. I like how sort of brutal it is. I like the way that it surprises you. You know, it introduces the football player early on, and you just assume, and he's played by sort of a star at the time, and you just assume, okay, here's my male lead, and then it does something very horrible to him early on. And it takes a lot of turns that I like. I really like that movie. And I really like Chuck Russell, who was there to speak.
Yeah, I thought his little talk was very worthwhile. And Rusty was speaking of maybe getting him to come back in October for The Massacre and showing Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which he also directed. And The Blob was a wonderful end of the evening because, of course, at that point we went home because no one needs to see Event Horizon.
I stuck around for a little while to meet Chuck Russell, and the line stretched into the theater, so I got to see, you know, the first 20 minutes of Event Horizon. And I remembered that I didn't really need to see Event Horizon, but a lot of people were there for it, so I was surprised. But it was a lot of fun. It was, like I said, kind of an up and down day. I don't know. I guess that beats putting all the slow stuff up front and then all the fun stuff, because that stretch would have been tough to get through. But we love the Science Fiction Spectacular. We love Rusty Nails. We love the Music Box.
And if you live anywhere near Chicago, you should check it out. In fact, in line, I was talking to Jason, yes, our friend from MovieSide and the internets, and he said he was at the Gene Siskel Film Center the other day and discovered that there's a gentleman who I believe lives in Michigan, and every weekend he drives to Chicago. He sees things at the Music Box Facets and Gene Siskel Film Center, sometimes in Cinemania style,
right,
where you're going from one screen to the other. I guess he crashes with his sister, and then at the end of the weekend he drives back to Michigan because, you know, he has a regular job. Wow.
Yeah.
My cup is lifted to you, O anonymous traveler in the night, who comes to Chicago to see screenings. But the Music Box is the happiest place on earth. The Portage does great shows, and there are strong rumors, actually there are more than rumors, there was an article in Time Out, that the Patio Theater, some people call it the Pay Show, on Irving Park is going to reopen very soon. And that holds about 1,500 people. So it would be very interesting if people started scheduling marathons and film festivals there.
That would be great. Holds, yeah, right.
That holds a lot of people.
Because what we need at these is more people.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I thought the Sci-Fi Spectacular was nicely attended.
Yeah.
Although we've noticed, and I think Jason and Rusty have noticed, that the Sci-Fi Spectacular is not as well attended as the Massacre. And that certainly some breathing room is nice, because mm-hmm. especially when the theater is old, when every seat is taken, it has this oppressive, weird vibe.
Yeah, yeah, it's tough.
So I actually prefer it to be 3/5 full, but I'm sure Rusty does not want it to be 3/5 full.
Probably not.
And would encourage you to go. What can you say?
All right, let's talk about Plan 9 from Outer Space.
And I've often felt that, like Monty Python the Holy Grail, this film is following me, because when I was much younger, in fact, I believe I was 18 when that book came out, I read about it. And of course, this was during the dark ages where you couldn't see movies. You just couldn't see them. Maybe because I was 18. You could read about them,
right,
and salivate about perhaps one magical day seeing them. But there were only a couple TV stations, and a VHS has not really been invented yet. And there were two theaters, the Varsity in Evanston and the Parkway in Chicago, that showed older films. In fact, the Parkway used to change its bill twice a week, wow, not just on Friday. They would change it on Friday and Tuesday. But if it didn't show up on TV, and whenever something good showed up on TV, it was at 3 o'clock in the morning, and if it didn't show up at the Varsity or the Parkway, you were out of luck. So you would read about these films. In my case, incessantly, and then when you finally got to see them, it was like a religious pilgrimage. Right, right. I remember Brewster McCloud. I think I went 3 or 4 years before I got to see that.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe that contributed to how much I liked it. But in 1980 or thereabouts, this book comes out, The 50 Worst Films of All Time, and I read about it, and then they finally show it at the Varsity, and I go with some friends. And I still remember how much we laughed, because there are parts of this film that are deliriously funny. And then much later, I directed a thing at school. It's called group interpretation. Some people call it chamber theater. And I did an adaptation of Plan 9 from Outer Space. Patrick saw it.
I did. It was good.
And in the spirit of Ed Wood, the judges did not like it. And gave us a very low score. So somewhere Ed is grinning. And I discovered through Google that someone was successful in turning it into a musical.
Mm.
And on YouTube, you can watch it in little 9-minute segments. And it's a little amateurish, and the songs are sort of forgettable, but it's kind of fun.
I guess, but again, it's just this whole...
Everything has to be a musical.
Not only does everything have to be a musical, but everything has to be, like, a musical to run at midnight for cult audiences, because everything is worth making fun of and making a joke out of. And I get that Plan 9 is goofy and impossible to take seriously. But at the same time, I don't think... I don't get anything out of watching Plan 9 and feeling superior to it.
No, because as I grow older, I begin to look at it in a different way, in that Ed Wood was very ambitious, but not very talented.
Right.
And, say what you want, he made movies.
Right. That's what he loved to do. Up until he died. And when he couldn't make movies anymore, he was making stuff for TV. He was making porn movies. I mean, and part of that spoke to a different
obsession. He was writing salacious paperback.
Right, but he loved to make movies and would do it any way he could. And I admire that.
And I thought the Tim Burton film got it right in that Ed Wood had this group of people around him that were so interesting and so colorful. And what I always compare it to is, when I started teaching, that was the year the Bears won the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a big sports fan, but what I liked about the 1985 Bears was, it was like you were watching a football movie, because every person on the team was a character.
Right.
You had Walter Payton, right, who had been with the team forever and finally was facing victory. And you had Jim McMahon, the punky QB who didn't play by the rules. And Ditka, who was something out of Ernest Hemingway. And then you had Mike Singletary, and then you had the refrigerator.
Yeah,
and the refrigerator was this big, goofy, fat guy. Right. And during one of the games, he actually scored a touchdown.
Super Bowl.
Oh, it was just,
Yeah.
It was what got me interested in sports, because this isn't football on a Sunday. This is a movie about football.
Yeah.
The same is true of Ed Wood and his team. You look at his friendship with Bela Lugosi at the end of his career, or him hooking up with Criswell, this awful television psychic, and him picking up Vampyra because Vampyra was in the process of being blacklisted and no one else would hire her. Or Tor Johnson, who's this professional wrestler who gets roped into playing these parts. Bunny Breckenridge, Dudley Manlove, Valda Hansen. I mean, it's delirious. It's like, I'm going to assemble a group around me who, even though they're all completely different, they're all exactly like interesting way.
Right.
So it was great that the Tim Burton film sort of focused on the team, as it were. And I'd like to suggest a book. It's called Nightmare of Ecstasy. It's terrific. In fact, I think the Tim Burton film gave a nod that that part of it, at least, was based on this.
Yeah.
And Rudolph Gray wrote the book. It's Nightmare of Ecstasy, The Life and Art of Ed Wood. And it's oral history. He did a series of interviews and then arranged them. And hidden in the book, very late in the book, it's on page 139, I think we actually have the secret to what makes Ed's films Ed's films, that they have this unique quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's in Plan 9. I was trying to rack my brain to figure out what movie this was from. But it strikes me as the quintessential Ed Wood line, and it's not one that's often quoted. It's voiceover narration, and it might be in at the beginning of Glen or Glenda. Look at the highway. All of those cars. All of them going somewhere. And I think that gets to the heart of Ed Wood's words, of Ed Wood's dialogue, that in a weird way, it's sort of deep, but it's not.
Right.
It's a child's version of something that's profound.
It's like filler, sort of. You know, it's like mental filler.
And Kathy Wood, his second and final wife, has this to add, and I think these two quotes, these two snippets, go a long way to explaining Ed Wood's style. Ed was never too much on the research bit. He was too impatient, but he was so fast on the IBM executive typewriter. Oh, God, he was fast. And even better, the second quote, again, this is on page 139 of Nightmare of Ecstasy. When he wrote, drinking seemed to help. He used to sit and talk, and it was such a nice progression of drinking and talking and drinking. And he'd wake up in the middle of the night, and he'd think of something, and thank God he wrote most of it on paper. The drinking helped. He was always close to a pencil. And between typing at god-awful speeds on the what was then new IBM electric typewriter and drinking, I think we have the explanation for why much of Plan 9 sounds like much of Plan 9.
Well, and that was something that the Tim Burton movie shied away from. It just presented sort of this very happy, positive, upbeat Ed Wood and didn't really acknowledge any of the demons that he may have had, including alcoholism.
And I always gave Johnny Depp credit because it seems now that Depp is sort of cashing in on his earlier fame. Mm-hmm. But for a 10 or 15 year stretch, I had so much respect for Johnny Depp because he always did something different. He always did something twisted and skewed, and none of his movies made money.
Right.
There was a period of time where if he was in your movie, it was the kiss of death. And the quality that Depp chose to go with on Ed Wood is precisely the quality of that line I just quoted. Look at all those cars, all of them going somewhere. That Depp's Ed Wood has this gee whiz quality.
Right, right.
That I really think was at the heart of the man. Because say what you want, he made movies that are still being shown today. And that's no mean achievement.
And that's what I like about his movies. And I can't necessarily sit through all of his movies repeatedly, but certainly Plan 9, because it does have this whole gee whiz attitude, although it does at the end it's sort of more... there is more of a commentary, sort of a dark commentary than it is like a gee whiz, yay. But the whole thing is sort of gee whiz, I'm making movies. And I really think, you know, again, there's this movement, especially now, it's only gotten worse in the last few years, that we love to embrace bad things ironically. This 12-year-old girl puts out a song about Friday. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
Yeah. This Rebecca Black, I think, is her name. And I don't even know anything about it until I find out it's the most downloaded song on iTunes. Because so many people think, oh, it's bad. I have to be all over that. I want to love this thing that's terrible because I get to feel superior to it. And I'm really tired of it. We're always looking for the next new terrible thing. We all love Charlie Sheen because he's a mess. And we go see Snakes on a Plane because doesn't that look hilarious? But I really think for something to be truly horrible, to truly be, you know, the worst movie ever made, or just a genuinely bad movie, it has to be artless, and it has to be cynical. And we pile a lot on the movie Grown Ups, which came out last summer, and that's a bad movie. And I would say that is a worse movie than Plan 9 from Outer Space, because it is cynical and it is artless. And I don't think that Plan 9 is either of those things.
No, in that in Plan 9, an attempt is made at art.
Right.
And there is a failure.
Right.
On some cinematic level.
But the art is in the attempt, I think.
But they are trying to make a movie.
Right.
They are trying to make a movie that makes sense in a narrative way. And again, getting back to Ed Wood's team, Ed took some home movie footage of Bela Lugosi, very close to his death, and they were just sort of puttering around. It was Bela in front of his house.
Stopping to smell a flower.
Stopping to smell a flower. And then Ed convinced Bela to put on his Dracula cape and to cavort about in this sort of forest preserve setting. And then Bela died. And realizing that he could rightly bill this as Bela Lugosi's last film, he used the footage and then famously had a stand-in play Bela in the other scenes. And it was his chiropractor, and the chiropractor was taller and had lighter hair and held the cape over his face. And but in the scenes with Lugosi, that film is infused with this amazing feeling, and maybe I'm reading into it because I know the backstory, that Ed Wood grew up loving Universal horror films and worshiping Bela Lugosi. And now he's directing him. And now he's befriended him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be the most terrific thing on earth. Mm-hmm. I'd like to be Bela Lugosi's friend. I missed that by a couple of years. So I don't see a shred of cynicism in Plan 9. And if I could make just one more comment about this cult of irony.
Yeah.
It seems interesting to me, and the real irony of this is that hipsters, my son derisively calls these people hipsters.
That's what they are.
They are seeking these things that they can make fun of. And I think by extension, from what I've seen, there's a real strain of, in making fun of this, I'm proving myself superior to it. So no one really watches Jersey Shore, because then you'd have to admit that you're watching a shitty show about really shitty people. Everyone watches it ironically in order to feel superior to what's on the screen. It's like that earlier MTV thing, My Super Sweet 16, where we can watch these greedy pigs of girls order their parents around and spend thousands of dollars. And I always thought that there were some people who watched that genuinely and thought, boy, I wish I was rich. But then the other half was watching it ironically. It seems to me these hipsters, these participants in the Church of Irony, that the final irony is most of these people would eschew most staid versions of community, and by this I mean things like the church and the Republican Party. And yet they've built their own version of it, because what is this other than your religion?
Right.
A religion that sneers at things. It reminds me of a line from Inherit the Wind. At the end of the film, the Spencer Tracy character confronts the Gene Kelly character, and it's supposed to be Clarence Darrow, confronting H.L. Mencken. And he says, "What do you believe in? You're like a ghost with an empty sleeve, pointing a finger and laughing at everything that people hold dear. Is nothing sacred to you? People, friends, an idea? You've got nothing. What do you believe in?" And that's more horrible than this little film could ever be. This little film, to say what you want, is very entertaining.
Right, and how could it be the worst movie ever made if it's as entertaining as it is? And certainly there are people who maybe have no affection for old science fiction movies or science fiction movies at all, who would flip past it on TV and see the flying saucers with the string clearly visible and say, "Look at that, I can see the string, this is garbage, this is the worst movie ever made." But again, you are missing the point entirely.
And as it turns out, I've read that Ed was actually really happy with how that special effect turned out. He thought it looked really, really good. There's one thing I know, and that is I have never seen this film with a large audience where certain lines haven't gotten a laugh. Mm-hmm. They're sort of sure laugh-getters. The one that I always think of is when the police detective says, "One thing's for sure, Inspector Clay is dead, murdered, and someone's responsible." And I've seen this with a group of hipsters. I've seen it with a group of regular people. I've seen it with my students. As an experiment once, I showed it to my students as the last film of the semester and told them nothing about it in advance. And none of them had ever heard of it.
Okay.
And I showed it to them, and when the screening was over, I turned on the lights and I said, "Tell me what you think of that movie." To see if they would instinctively.
Right.
And part of it is the teacher who we know knows something about film is showing this to us.
Right.
So is there something we're not seeing?
Right.
None of them picked up on the irony. A lot of them talked about how dull it was.
Yeah.
That they thought long stretches of it were boring.
Yeah.
They sort of had to be told why the film has. I mean, I really, for as long as I possibly could, I kept drawing out their feedback. But I wonder if people approach this film cold without 20 years of "It's the worst film ever made," the director dressed like a woman. He did. In fact, and this is actually in the Tim Burton film too. This is one of the many delirious quotes I found in the book. Valda Hansen, who appeared in some of Ed Wood's films, once said, And again, as you see in the Tim Burton film, he liked to wear Angora sweaters. He had a real thing for Angora, and then he often dressed as a woman, even on the set. He used to boast that in the Army during World War II, he was wearing women's clothing under his uniform. Valda Hansen said he loved women, but he'd like to wear eyelashes sometime, and lipstick too, when he put those gowns on. It's like he loves women so much, he's taking on the persona and becoming, having this woman wrapped around him and in him. And that quote gives me pause. There's your science fiction film. There's your horror film.
He's a madman, you know, but in a great way. And like you said, he is limited by his talent. But again, I part of it is I'm always an apologist for the movie that is an ambitious failure. Always.
Yes.
And all of his
movies. This is a hallmark of Patrick's personality.
But, you know, all of his movies are that. And so I admire that he really goes for it, and he's limited by his abilities.
In the strangest way, it's such an American story. Right? This young man did not let his lack of talent stand in his way. He found a way to push forward and make 8 or 10 films.
Right. And sometimes had to almost con people to do it. I mean, he had to keep finding new ways to make his movies because, you know, in the Tim Burton movie, famously, the money from this movie, which was originally called Grave Robbers from Outer Space,
yes,
came from the church.
A religious group.
Right. And
who wanted to make movies based on the Bible.
Right.
But couldn't afford it. And
they needed a moneymaker first.
Ed Wood said, you make one of these cheap horror science fiction films, you make a mint.
Right.
How he would reach that conclusion based on the success of his previous films is unknown, but it worked. And in fact, the religious group forced the title change,
right,
having a dim view of grave robbing. To the end of his life, Ed Wood would continually say that he wished it were Grave Robbers. He says the title of that film is Grave Robbers from Outer Space. It's not Plan 9 from Outer Space.
I like the title Plan 9 from Outer Space, but I'm sure that's just affection I have for it because of the movie. But yeah, even Criswell in the opening never says the words Plan 9 from Outer Space. He says Grave Robbers from Outer Space.
And speaking of Criswell, by way of introduction, we have what will be the final quote from this book. I don't want this podcast to be JB's book time. I have the greatest quote. John Andrews was a friend and confidant of Criswell, and in the Nightmare of Ecstasy book, he says, I'm sitting up at Criswell's, and we're drinking. Do we see a theme here? And he says, do you know, those idiots are actually buying my book. They actually believe I can predict the future. Shit, I couldn't look out the window and tell you what the weather's like. Amazing. He was on Johnny Carson dozens of times. Yeah. Dozens of times.
You know, again, and I keep going back to, this isn't the worst movie ever made, and we've already established that, so I don't need to necessarily keep defending Plan 9 from Outer Space. But I think it's one of those things that unfortunately caught on, that someone said, this is the worst movie ever made, and now we just sort of accept that without questioning why that is. And there are definitely, like you said, a lot of things that are wrong with it. The dialogue and the pacing and the shaking tombstone and all that stuff. But, you know, just like you said, the cast is made up of such larger-than-life, colorful people that even every time they come on screen, they're interesting to look at. Tor Johnson is interesting to look at. Vampyra is very interesting to look at.
Every time Plan 9 was on Outer Space, Ed Wood would call all of his friends and say, hey, it's on tonight. Watch it. And again, to his dying day, said, the one shot of Tor rising from the grave is honestly creepy and very, very memorable.
Yeah.
And he was right. To those hipsters who would maintain that Plan 9 is the worst movie ever made, I think Patrick and I only have one thing to say.
Because all you of Earth are idiots.
And then Eros goes into a long and convoluted explanation of the Solar Knight. And I still remember the first time I saw this film, the extent to which the actor, Dudley Manlove, not his real name, goes in describing this and this extended metaphor that the sun is a tennis ball and we soak it in gasoline. And this explanation, it goes on and on and on.
Ed Wood typed very fast.
And he was drunk. And again, in the Nightmare of Ecstasy book, Manlove was interviewed and says, Ed Wood took me aside and said, if you could do this whole thing in one take, it would really save us a lot of time and money. And he did it. If you watch it, that is a long, long speech, and it's from one angle. That's like almost 2 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And he said throughout the film, he tried to do long things in one take to save time and save money. So, yo, Dudley Manlove. And speaking of Dudley Manlove, if you're really interested in esoterica, there's another Dudley Manlove performance you have to check out. The film is called Creation of the Humanoids, and it's obscure.
Yeah.
I saw it when I was a kid on Channel 32, and then later in life, I read so little about it and saw it mentioned so few times anywhere, I began to think that I had dreamt it. It was very strange, and then the Psychotronic Encyclopedia came out, and that had an entry for Creation of the Humanoids. It's a very strange film. It was said to be Andy Warhol's favorite film. The entire thing is filmed like it's a stage play. It's very stagey. Don McGowran's in it. And it's about a future civilization where human-like robots are becoming more and more prevalent. But what the film is actually about is racism, because there's a group of people who don't like the robots, who have green skin, they're bald, and have silver eyeballs. They look like Blue Man Group by way of science fiction. And that there's a organized resistance to these robots who are derisively called clickers.
Mm.
So it's a racism allegory. Mm. And Dudley Manlove is in the film as one of these robots, almost unrecognizable because of the makeup and the contact lenses. And in Creation of the Humanoids, he's given this soliloquy because he's fallen in love with the sister of the leader of the racist anti-robot brigade. It's amazing. In the 80s, it got re-released on VHS because one of the characters in the movie, the scientist, looks a little bit like, oh, good Lord, Christopher Lloyd.
Okay.
So on the VHS box, they made him into Christopher Lloyd, and I guess trying to trick people into thinking that it's Christopher Lloyd.
For all those people who need to see every performance Christopher Lloyd has ever given.
Yes.
Christopher Lloyd's in this. I'm renting Camp Nowhere.
There you go. Or Piranha.
Yes.
3D. It was recently re-released on DVD on a double feature with War of the Something. I don't know. It's well worth checking out. It was not released on DVD with War of the Worlds. That can stand on its own. Danny Perry, in 1981, published his first cult movies book, and I've been grabbing essays from this book and its sequels for years and years because they're very concise pictures of what makes these movies so famous to their small, you know, coterie of fans. And the book was so popular, it spawned Cult Movies 2 and Cult Movies 3. Many, many years ago, Mr. Bromley was in a film study class and read many of these essays from the cult movie book.
Yes.
And with your permission, I'd like to read this.
Yeah.
Because I think it gets to the heart.
Out loud, right?
Well,
or silently to yourself.
I was going to sit here and read this to myself again.
All right.
And I thought to entertain the podcast listeners, you would sing.
Okay. No, I'll read it out loud instead. I don't want to sing.
Plan 9 is a delirious movie, and at this point I have to break off because I've brought this up on other podcasts that really great films always reach a point, and sometimes more than one point, where they completely go off the tracks and become... And lately I've been trying to find a synonym for this because I don't like delirious or delirium. Rudolph Gray comes close when he says Nightmare of Ecstasy, that it becomes this thing that's just so weird and so different and so unlike anything you've ever seen, or how about this, so unexpected. You never thought it was going to go in this direction. Mm-hmm. That I have a homework assignment for you podcast listeners. You have to email Patrick and suggest a word for this phenomenon.
Okay.
The point at which the good film becomes a great film by going completely off the rails and spinning your head around. We need a term for that in much the same fashion as Dan Savage, the advice columnist in The Reader, invented the word...
Santorum.
Santorum.
Yeah.
The less said, the better. Plan 9 is a delirious movie, but perhaps we are missing the point. Could it be that putting up a crazy facade is the only way that Wood could get away with making a subversive movie? Remember, this is a radical, iconoclastic director who promoted transvestism in Glenn or Glenda and protested the arms race by ending Bride of the Monster with a nuclear explosion. All through Plan 9, there are inferences that the U.S. government is wrongly keeping facts from the public. Jeff is upset he can't report the flying saucer he sighted. Colonel Edwards is peeved that the destruction of an entire town has been covered up. And there is a government directive stating flying saucers are just a rumor, despite the fact that the government has received radio messages. How can a race be so stupid? The aliens ask politely. The really peculiar thing about Plan 9, which film historians have overlooked completely, is that when Eros, in that little soundbite I just played, confronts Trent Edwards and the lieutenant, only the fact that he has a diabolical laugh and a lot of conceit covers up that what he says to them makes sense. When Eros calls the Earthling stupid, headstrong, and violent, Jeff is so insulted that he reacts in a stupid, headstrong, and violent way. He slaps Eros. Actually, I think it's a punch.
Yeah.
And Eros responds that Earthlings make no use of the mind that God gave you. The fact that the aliens believe in God is further proof that Eros is Wood's spokesman, the film's one voice of reason and logic. And Jeff and Edwards, whom we mistakenly accepted as heroes, turn out to be brutish jerks who rely on the fist and the gun. Don't let the fact that Eros is a maniac throw you off. At rare moments, he is as sound a visionary as the preacher Casey in The Grapes of Wrath. Wood had to make Eros crazy to camouflage his political message so that he wouldn't have trouble with censors. I believe that in this one scene, in this one god-awful, terribly made, poor excuse for a picture, Ed D. Wood is more critical of America's government and military strategy than any other director dared to be. Plan 9, dreadful as it is something far more significant, and therefore better, than the worst film of all time could ever be. And whenever I read that, and I read that a lot, I always envision this being read by Steve Martin on an old episode of Saturday Night Live. And after that long screed supporting the film, there's a pause, and then Steve Martin goes, nah.
Yeah.
It's a loony film that deserves a loony explanation.
Yeah, right. But, you know, if nothing else, even if you're saying that Ed Wood wasn't even necessarily cognizant of some of those things, that he wasn't necessarily deliberately disguising things as an attempt to sneak them through, but that they exist in the film still because they existed in Ed Wood's head, it's obvious that it's a movie with ideas, and no truly terrible movie has ideas. Bad movies have no ideas, and that's why they're bad.
Well, as you said, Grown Ups has one idea that a key film-going demographic has an amount of affection for these men from Saturday Night Live and from earlier, better movies. And it's the summer, and if we make a movie about these supposedly beloved actors going on a vacation, people in the summer will go see it.
Which is cynicism.
And it's so bad. We talked about this on the summer wrap-up. I'm still angry at that film. That film makes me so angry for so many reasons, but mostly because it's really unfunny.
Yeah.
And that's lazy. on the part of everyone involved, because at the very least, those men are capable of being funny, which isn't easy, but clearly they've proven that they're capable of it. Again, like you said, the laziness and cynicism in that film just floors me.
And look at something like, which you haven't, a movie you haven't seen, but you can imagine Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, which again has all of the money and resources at its disposal that one could ever hope for, and yet the special effects are noise, and they just are dull. And you look at something like Plan 9 from Outer Space, which has historically bad special effects, and maybe this is just a personal thing on my part, that what I like about Plan 9 from Outer Space is, yeah, I can see the string hanging, but what that does to me is it conjures up these ideas of somebody sitting in a room painting a flying saucer and making it because they're going to put it on camera and make a movie. And Transformers has none of that sort of imagination, none of that spirit that I think Plan 9 has. And again, maybe I'm just being an apologist for Plan 9 from Outer Space. I don't know.
And I still remember your near apoplectic rage the summer that the first Transformers movie came out, not only because it's big and bad, so big and bad that I haven't seen it. I don't think I will ever see it, so maybe I can't comment on it. But a recent decision that I made, that I would not go to movies that I knew would just hyper me into a frenzy of anger and disgust. But as the summer went on, your pained reaction to people who said it was their favorite movie of all time,
right,
that there are lots and lots of people who thinks that's a really great movie.
Right.
Perhaps less so with the sequel. I know I didn't read very many positive reviews of the sequel.
And yet everyone will go see the third one.
Yes, because the trailer is so captivating.
But again, I'm the a-hole because I come out of Transformers and say, I didn't like it. And they say, well, what did you expect? It's giant robots fighting. As though describing what's in the movie is enough for me to lower my standards and just say, oh, you're right. That movie had the thing that you're saying, so therefore it is good.
But ultimately, then you would excuse... It's
the snakes on a plane phenomenon.
You would excuse grown-ups because what were you expecting? It was an Adam Sandler movie.
Right.
It had Adam Sandler in it. Stop your bitching.
You could make that argument for every movie, and that argument holds no water.
The joke that I continually made that summer when people expressed amazement that I wasn't seeing Transformers, because most of my friends and family know that I see a boatload of movies, they couldn't believe that I had not gone to see that. And the joke that I used, that actually lasted about a year and a half, given DVD and then cable and stuff, and students who still express shock that I haven't seen it, is I will pause and I will say, no, I haven't seen it, but I understand it's about robots in disguise. And then we just leave it at that. One thing I just remembered about Plan 9 and another one of the eight reasons. Speaking of eight reasons, Ed Wood preferred Grave Robbers from Outer Space. Criswell says Grave Robbers from Outer Space. Only the title card says Plan 9. Doesn't this make you wonder, because it's made me wonder,
what plans 1 through 8
were? What were the first 8 plans?
Right.
Because when they mention Plan 9, the leader has to grab something off the desk, which is obviously the script, and says, oh yes, Plan 9, Resurrection of the Dead. I would love to know what plans 1 through 8 are. One of the many reasons...
They all involved the dead. But none involved resurrecting them.
Plan 1, kick the dead.
Desecration of the dead. Decoration of the dead.
Plan 3, mocking the dead.
America will become so enraged
that we are mocking the dead. Eros goes up to a dead guy and starts dancing. Hey, Mr. Dead Guy, don't you want to dance?
You can't. You're dead.
One of the many reasons I hold the film close to my heart, many years ago, Miguel, who is a big friend of F This Movie, and I traveled west to the second Famous Monsters convention that was held in California. And I discovered that whenever one of these events is held in California, oh, the celebrities they get, because that's where they live. Right. That's where celebrities live. In fact, I ran into Dan Roebuck at that convention and first found out that, besides being a working actor, and I think back then he was on Matlock, he is a rabid horror and science fiction fan, and that was fun. And in a story that I've never told on the podcast, they had a costume contest, and the ballroom was full of people and really hot and stuffy. So Miguel and I walked out onto the front driveway where the people who wanted to be judged for the costume contest were. And we were just sort of walking around talking to people in costumes and taking pictures. And it was a lot more fun than being in the ballroom. And there was a tall guy in a Nosferatu costume that was really nice. I mean, the coat was beautiful. The mask was the best Nosferatu mask I've ever seen. Make a long story short, months later we discovered that was Michael Jackson.
Really?
Michael Jackson was a big horror and science fiction fan, couldn't go anywhere, and saw this as his opportunity to interact with, because he was in disguise. Because there was a guy standing next to him. Miguel took a picture of me next to this Nosferatu guy. Mm-hmm. And then there's a guy in vaguely Nosferatu Bremen Town costume.
And that was Tito Jackson?
No.
Oh.
That was his bodyguard.
Oh, no kidding.
And I...
Do you think the bodyguard resented that? Really, Mike, I got to put on the costume again.
Oh, no. It was clearly sort of an attempt. And it worked because it just looked like this was the guy's friend. Because usually everyone has a buddy. And I still wish I had taken Miguel's picture with this Nosferatu guy. Because I still have the picture. I later scanned it. And I have it in my laptop. And it's my brush with greatness. Because it's me standing next to Michael Jackson, albeit Michael Jackson dressed as Nosferatu. To get back to the story. At this convention, I met Conrad Brooks, who really used to do the convention circuit. He used to be at every convention, and he has a small part in Plan 9, and later ponied that into a successful career of going to these conventions and talking about Ed Wood. And I met Vampyra, who was also at the convention very late in her life, and both of them had this wonderful quality. Again, earlier we were talking about Ed Wood's team. Really, really nice, really thankful that this film being rediscovered gave them a chance to get out, to get around other people who had similar interests, to regain a little bit of fame, or at least, and we've talked about this in terms of movie conventions and Comic-Cons and horror and science fiction conventions, that some people miss the fan attention, and this certainly gave that to them, but they were very, very nice and very generous with their time, and Mela Nurmi, Vampyra, of course, has since passed away, but that's a really, really happy memory that I actually got to meet some of the original cast of Plan 9.
And they didn't resent that the movie had been rediscovered as being the worst movie ever made?
No, not at all. Although in the book, Vampyra is sort of she's sort of upset that, well, she should be upset that she was blacklisted because that sort of ended her TV career, that she sort of resents the fact that Ed Wood exploited her.
Right.
Although I would argue that besides the fact that she's sort of seen now as Elvira before Elvira, and I think at one point she sued Elvira lost, that I would say that Vampyra right now is most known for Plan 9.
Yes.
So this is real irony, as opposed to hipster irony, that this thing she may have resented and thought was exploitative is actually the thing for which she'll be remembered.
Yeah, and she's on a documentary that's on the Plan 9 DVD called like Flying Saucers Over Hollywood or something, and I watched a little bit of it last night, and I liked hearing her speak and everything, but I didn't like I only want to remember her as Vampyra. I didn't like seeing her out of her Vampyra outfit.
And certainly out of her Vampyra outfit, she looks completely different.
Yeah.
Not unlike Cassandra Peterson, who looks nothing like Elvira.
Right.
So earlier, the homework assignment was find a phrase or a term for this moment of delirium in truly great films. And I would suggest to our podcast listeners, whom we love, that I have a second homework assignment.
All right.
Let us search for the worst film ever made.
Okay.
It's not Plan 9.
No.
But it would be great if people could email F This Movie.
FThisMoviePodcast@gmail.com.
and suggest what they think is the worst movie of all time.
Yes. No Troll 2, No The Room, No Manos, The Hands of Fate.
We will post them and talk about them. And my nomination would be, it is a Sun Classic documentary. Sun Classic used to four wall, which means they'd go to an area, they'd literally rent the theater for a set amount, and then they would show the film and keep all the profits. It's what Kevin Smith is currently doing with Red State.
Right.
And they made a lot of money on In Search of Noah's Ark and The Adventures of the Wilderness Family. And a book by Eric von Däniken, Chariots of the Gods, was very popular. So they made a documentary called In Search of Ancient Astronauts. I actually went to see this at the Mount Prospect Theater, which is no longer there. That, I think, is the worst movie I've ever seen.
Okay.
Utterly devoid of anything that you go to the movies for that would keep you awake. I mean, it is awful. And oddly enough, it has that cynicism that you speak of, that not only is this dreck, but it has cynically been made because this company knows that if they buy this many screens and do this much TV advertising, because the TV advertising was relentless, 3 days only in Antioch, border town, and it's like one of my chief childhood memories, these incessant local television commercials for Sun Classic films. I think this was before your time.
Yeah.
Because I was a kid.
Yeah.
I got roped into seeing In Search of Ancient Astronauts.
It's a good title.
Oddly enough, far worse than Plan 9, and yet about some of the same things. So there you go. That's my nomination.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
And remember, future events such as these will affect you in the future and will affect redundancy.